Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Here we are with the benefit of some time over the Christmas break to be able to send you out some really, really good content and some interesting ideas about modern history. So today we're going to take a dive into looking at the Suez Crisis. We've approached the Suez here on the podcast many times before. And the reason why we keep coming back to it is this pivotal moment in the 20th century for a variety of different reasons. Firstly, and most obviously, it is a huge stepping stone on the road to British imperial decline, as great power politics and great power ambitions by Great Britain and France, let us not forget, were replaced by the realities of the Cold War. The British ultimately are given an ultimatum by America that they need to retreat from Suez. In James Barr's brilliant book, Lords of the Desert, a different conception is he places a different kind of view on it, that not only was there the Cold War between America and the Soviet Union ongoing, but also there was a kind of a Cold War in the desert between America and Great Britain over the subject of influence in the Middle East. There are the issues of Arab-Israeli conflict. Of course, Israel is chiefly involved in the attack on Egypt. And, of course, France's own struggles to prevent her imperial, her empire from going into terminal decline, as it had done 2 years earlier in Vietnam at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, and as it was doing in Algeria. So it's one of these kind of crossroads of 20th century history, which is why it's so important to explore. So today we're looking once again in Martin Thomas's brilliant book Fight or Flight, an amazing resource that I really, really recommend. He begins by looking at the causes and the plans for the attack on Suez. By way of context, for those who haven't really explored this before, very briefly, Britain had been a colonial power in Egypt since 1882, and by the in the kind of the post-war era, mainly occupied the canal zone. The Suez Canal having been created by Ferdinand de Lesseps and part-owned between France and Egypt, But the Khedive of Egypt in 1876 went bankrupt, and Benjamin Disraeli, the British Prime Minister, along with the Rothschild Bank, bought the Egyptian shares in the canal, and thus making it an Anglo-French asset and a key tool for a hugely important strategic asset in connecting Britain with its Asian empire. By the 1950s, it was mostly the conduit by which Europe and the West received oil from the Middle East. So Martin Thomas writes, "The Suez Canal Zone, 31st October 1956, the one event in the calendar of decolonisation when British and French resolved to fight against imperial withdrawal spectacularly and calamitously converged. I cannot imagine a worse act of aggression," wrote Indian Premier Jawaharlal Nehru on hearing news that Egypt had been invaded by Israeli, British and French forces. "The whole future of the relations between Europe and Asia hangs in the balance." The invasion to which he referred was the outcome of a secret Franco-British deal with Israel, the Sèvres Protocol of the 24th of October. On one of the most infamous arrangements in the entire history of modern European empire, it concocted false pretexts to attack Egypt. The aim was to depose the country's troublesome ruler, General Gamal Abdel Nasser, quickly, before either his armed forces or his foreign friends could do much about it. The protocol was agreed over 3 days of discussion. At its centre was a high-level Israeli negotiating team consisting of Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, Chief of Staff Moshe Dayan, and Defence Ministry Director Shimon Peres, who met with their counterparts in Guy Mollet's French government. The talks were held in the quiet suburban home of the Bonnier de Chapelle family. The family's devotion to the resistance was exemplary, like that of the French premier, who had endured repeated arrests and Gestapo interrogation. Indeed, their 18-year-old son was executed for involvement in the assassination of Admiral Darlan, Vichy's imperial plenipotentiary in Algiers, on Christmas Eve 1942. All of this endeared the Israeli visitors to their French hosts. Foreign Secretary Selwyn Lloyd, who represented British interests at Sèvres, with two Foreign Office advisers, arrived later, by which time the bonhomie between the French and the Israelis was in full flow. Some interesting dynamics seem to kind of emerge at this meeting. That Selwyn Lloyd, a kind of a rather conservative with a small c character, less inclined to talk of gung-ho action and extreme adventurism, comes slightly later to the party. The Israelis and the French seem very, very kind of committed to the course of action and very excited about what can happen and what will be possible. And the Selwyn Lloyd, as a representative of Great Britain, seems on some level sort of slightly kind of unsuited to the exchange, the discussions that are going on. The French and Israeli participants, even the opposite number of Selwyn Lloyd, Christian Pigneux, who had also served in the resistance, seemed to have a strong connection with the Israelis, many of whom who had actually served in the Haganah and conspired against Britain in the Mandate of Palestine in 1948. So there were levels of connection between the Israelis and the French where they were considering the overthrow of another regime, that perhaps the British weren't really kind of fully part of. This was a far cry, writes Martin Thomas, from Lloyd's war service as a senior officer in the British Second Army that had pushed through northwest Europe after D-Day. There is a really interesting point made by David Edgerton in The Rise and Fall of the British Nation, when he talks about how many British cabinet ministers in the post-war era, from Clement Attlee all the way up to some of Thatcher's cabinet, people like Jim Pryor and Willie Whitelaw, who had been army officers, and how much of the kind of the culture of militarism, but also kind of a military understanding and judgment, was integrated into British cabinets all the way up until the 1980s. By the 1990s, this goes into terminal decline, and the return of such extreme adventuring in the Middle East as Iraq is in some way related to that. The total lack of any sort of understanding of risks, consequences, exit strategies, or anything like that. Martin Thomas writes, "Whatever Lloyd's discomfort, the British government's commitment to the deal eventually done was never in doubt. It was just that neither the Foreign Office nor the Cabinet wished to advertise the fact. Israeli forces would advance into the Sinai Desert, paving the way for an Anglo-French expeditionary force to occupy the Canal Zone and separate the warring Israeli and Egyptian armies. Ruthlessly Machiavellian, Operation Musketeer was worthy of Stalin, whose political heirs were, at the time, busy crushing a popular uprising in Budapest. Western democracies and NATO partners, even those with mounting imperial worries, supposedly upheld upheld higher standards. Or did they? Nero had a point. Invasion turned into fiasco in barely a week." The question of NATO is an interesting one here. Obviously, all NATO powers are able to operate independent foreign policies until, of course, one is attacked, and then that's very much kind of off the table. An attack on one is an attack on all. But NATO powers as aggressors in their own right presented an interesting and perhaps unexpected dynamic within the alliance, to especially to people like Eisenhower, the US president. The idea that two NATO powers would, in secret, ally with a third power and invade a sovereign nation in order to further their own interests, at the same time as being part of the Western anti-Soviet alliance, essentially carrying on like the Imperial Buccaneers they still imagine themselves to be, was utterly incongruous, utterly sort of incompatible to the functioning of the Western military alliance. And the Western military alliance revolved around Washington, which meant that the ability of countries like Britain and France to manoeuvre on their own and to really reclaim their own strategic and colonial and imperial objectives, that was something that was completely unacceptable to Eisenhower, and he makes that abundantly clear fairly shortly afterwards. So SEWIS itself is kind of a shorthand for historians to indicate a kind of a turning point or a watershed moment in its impact on decolonisation. The Prime Minister of the day, Anthony Eden, who was chronically ill with chronic pain and a variety of ailments from a failed operation. Perhaps the more sympathetic way of looking at him, it was he was misguided. He was naive. He was the historians that cut him a lot of slack suggest that the kind of the pressure he was under from his own ill health clouded his judgment.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The idea that he was a deceitful figure is perhaps slightly more apt, or even delusional. The idea that he felt that this was a sensible course of action that could arrest British imperial decline. Eden had felt that he had been provoked by Nasser for a long, long time. Nasser had made various kind of state policy statements and had made various speeches that demeaned Eden as the kind of the unfortunate understudy to Churchill, who had resigned in the previous couple of years. Eden was, of course, had been, of course, frustrated and determined to replace Churchill, seeing him as the kind of the foolish old man. Churchill having returned to power after his defeat at the hands of Labour, having returned to power in 1951, and Churchill in his later years had clearly begun to kind of lose his ability to focus, his concentration, his health, and all the rest. So Eden was raring to go and desperate to prove himself. Eden himself had been a very, very popular figure. He'd had a very good war. He'd been Churchill's foreign secretary during the war and had had some fairly distinguished political service and had been a statesmanly figure representing Britain around the world during the war. But in the 1950s, kind of almost like a different sort of character emerges, a far more self-serving, self-interested careerist, obsessed with his standing and determined to prove himself as a significant political figure. Eden stepped down, writes Martin Thomas, in January 1957, a broken man, after the Eisenhower administration condemned the Suez venture and pulled the financial rug from underneath it. His career in ruins, the former Prime Minister remained unrepentant. If anything, now more convinced in the aftermath of the crisis that before it, that the overthrowing the Cairo regime made sense. Such blinkered intransigence left him exposed to ridicule. Eden's opposite number was the bespectacled, football-loving Anglophile, the French socialist leader Guy Mollet. The Frenchman was blessed with neither Eden's suaveness nor his good looks. Eden, the old Etonian, had been dubbed Lord Eyelashes by Italian journalists in the 1930s. Mollet, a former schoolteacher from Arras in Normandy, bore a striking resemblance to comedian Arthur Askey, and those who might be aware of Arthur Askey will know that's not a very, very flattering look. French socialists, by then a highly disciplined party, held together despite vigorous complaint from the young socialist wing led by Michel Rocard. Yet Mollet's centre-left Republican Front also collapsed a few months later, not over Suez, but over the issue that inspired the visceral French hatred of Nasser the Algerian War. Nasser, as a pan-Arab nationalist, who really hoped to create a kind of a union of Arab nations, radically opposed to European colonisation of the Middle East and sitting independently within the milieu of the Cold War, had, of course, done everything he could do to help aid and encourage Algerian rebels against the French. So he was looked upon with the kind of loathing that perhaps British elite circles reserved for figures like Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness during the Troubles. It was Nasser's announcement that the Suez Canal would be nationalised that brought matters to a head for the British and the French. This was intolerable. The idea that something that belonged to the British and the French would be taken into state hands was unacceptable. In 1953, when the Anglo-Persian Oil Company was threatened with nationalisation by Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, the CIA and MI6 worked together with reactionary groups within Iran in order to overthrow the Mossadegh regime. Under the claim that, you know, Mossadegh was moving far too close to the Soviet Union and was going to draw Iran into Soviet sphere of influence, which was a nonsense. There is no intention on the part of Mossadegh, who was nothing more than an Iranian nationalist, of handing the country over to Stalin and then later Khrushchev. There was no question of that occurring whatsoever. It was a useful way of motivating American presidents to act against the threat of nationalisation. And so too, the threat of nationalising the Suez Canal would have been an enormous blow to the agendas of both Britain and France, and the world position of both Britain and France. And Martin Thomas expresses it thusly. Emerging from Downing Street on the 28th of June 1956, Harold Macmillan, still Chancellor at this time, recorded the sense of imperial problems clamouring for cabinet attention in the weeks before Nasser's announcement of the Suez Canal nationalisation. Terrible agenda. Cyprus, Malta, Libya, Egypt, all trouble and mostly blackmail. After nationalisation on the 26th of July, Suez became the all-consuming issue for an inner circle of favoured ministers in an Egypt committee. Its deliberations were often closed to wider cabinet or Whitehall advice. For 3 months, from mid-July to mid-October, Eden and fellow committee members, including the Foreign Secretary, Lloyd, Macmillan and Lord Salisbury, Robert Cecil, formerly Viscount Cranborne, talked of using force only as a last resort. But in a way, their past imperial rhetoric had already boxed them into a corner. Previous right-wing criticism of Labour's scuttle from Palestine and its handling of Persia's nationalisation of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company in the Abadan crisis of May 1951 constrained conservative choices in late 1956, suggesting that a firm handle in the Middle East was overdue. And of course, the British press were in no doubt as to the right thing to do, as inevitably Britain's newspapers tend to. They focused on immediate action to deal with the threat of nationalisation and restore British national pride in the Middle East. By presenting Nasser as another Hitler, which is an absurd proposition, and being and presenting Eden as a possible Neville Chamberlain, an appeaser, somebody that backs down to the enemy, it makes for a simple narrative that British newspaper consumers understood, but it started to cut away the choices that Eden had. So not only the previous policy of attacking any labour perceived weakness in the Middle East made it impossible for the Conservatives to do anything else other than go straight to aggression. So too, the normally right-wing government-supporting daily newspapers, the Express, the Mail and the Telegraph, put immense pressure on the government to be firm and to take action. All three newspapers, of course, and this goes without saying, remained unrepentant when the whole scheme backfired. Martin Thomas writes, their imperialism, the imperialism of British newspapers, at least, was openly displayed. Most of Eden's fellow ministers were less forthright in public. The majority either shared their leader's apocalyptic vision of Nasser as an Arab Mussolini bestriding the Arab world, or they acquiesced in it. Only two junior ministers resigned in protest. A third, a more senior minister, the Minister of Defence, Walter Monckton, quit his job for the lesser stresses of Postmaster General. More typical was Macmillan, the leader of the Bolters, in other words, those ministers quickest to disavow their earlier backing for Eden. He was preeminent among his cabinet, among the cabinet members, anxious to draw a veil over the early enthusiasm for military intervention. British service chiefs were more honest. Chief of Imperial General Staff Sir Gerald Templer endorsed the tripartite invasion or Operation Musketeer. First Sea Lord Mountbatten opposed it, and Air Chief Marshal Sir Dennis Smallwood dismissed Eden's excuses for action as utterly phony. In Parliament and the country, political parties, no less than radio listeners, pub drinkers, families and long-time friendships, split over the issue. Labour boasted several strongly pro-Zionist figures who were willing to back Israel. The Conservative backbenchers, rather like the Whitehall Civil Service, were never monolithically imperialist, but expressed a wide spectrum of opinion, from moral disgust to the die-hard empire loyalism of the Suez Club rowdies Lord Salisbury, Julian Amory, and Neil Billy McLean. One of the most high-profile ruptures was between the government and the BBC. The corporation was uncomfortable with the role of semi-official government cheerleader, both in its domestic programming and in its Arabic language broadcasting. That Suez was immensely divisive is beyond doubt, but it was the definitive post-war turning point for the British Empire. And indeed for the French. So we're going to return to this pretty soon, but it's important to remember with Suez something that Margaret Thatcher said at the time of the Falklands in 1982, was that after the disaster of Suez, the British never really dared to try something so audacious, so assertive on the world stage again. And it was Margaret Thatcher's contention, probably falsely, that the Falklands kind of restored the confidence for Britain to act as an independent power. Again, there's virtually no sense that that's actually true at all, but sometimes you have to delve into the kind of the fantasies that politicians engage in order to understand what it is that they believe. But certainly Suez had a fundamental effect on the functioning of British foreign policy for more than a generation. Anyway, thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.